Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Today we're joined by Dan Schrider, assistant professor in the Department of Genetics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. My discussion with Dan starts with an overview of population genomics, and from there, digs into his application of machine learning in the field, allowing us to, for example, better understand population size changes and gene flow from DNA sequences. We then dig into Dan's recent paper, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Convolutional Neural Networks in Population Genetic Inference, which was published in the Molecular Biology and Evolution Journal. The paper examines the idea that CNNs are capable of outperforming expert-derived statistical methods for some key problems in the field. Before we dive in, a quick thanks to our friends at Pegasystems, sponsors of today's show. PegaWorld, the company's annual digital transformation conference, which will be held at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas from June 2nd to 5th, is just a couple of months away now. I'll be attending the event as I did last year and will once again be presenting. In addition to hearing from me, the event is a great opportunity to learn how AI is applied to the customer experience at real Pega customers. As a Twimmel listener, you can use the promo code TWIMMEL19 for $200 off of your registration. Again, that code is TWIMMEL19. Hope to see you there. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am on the line with Dan Schrider. Dan is an assistant professor in the Department of Genetics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dan, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. It's great to have you on the show. So you have an undergraduate degree in computer science, but you are now an evolutionary biologist. Can you tell us about that transition and how it led you to work in machine learning?
Sure. Yeah. So it's actually sort of a series of transitions. And it started when I was in undergrad, I was studying computer science. I got into that field because I liked to write code in high school. I didn't really know what I was going to do with it. And during, I believe, my sophomore year, I started going to seminars about sort of various topics in computational research. And I heard about this thing called bioinformatics. And it turned out that you could write code to do research in biology. And I thought that sounded amazing. I always sort of liked the idea of being a scientist, though I didn't know much about biology at the time. And the night after that seminar, I immediately started looking into taking biology courses and sort of shifting focus. And from that moment forward, I was training to become a biological researcher as well as a you know, someone with computer programming skills. I was not sort of keen on the idea of being a software engineer. And when I heard that, oh, someone like me can, you know, be a biologist, I thought that was really cool. So started doing that. And when I wrapped up my degree, I decided to stay at Indiana University and started working there with Matthew Hahn, who was my PhD advisor there. And our area of research was population genetics, which is a subfield of evolutionary biology where you're sort of looking at the evolutionary dynamics of gene sequences, especially in recent evolutionary history. And you do this by looking at sort of the patterns of genetic variation that are present within a population. So you go out to nature, sample a bunch of individuals, sequence their genomes, and see what sense you can make of all the variation there. Started that at the beginning of grad school, fell in love with it, and haven't really looked away since. Now you might be gathering that this involves a lot of data analysis, a lot of sequence analysis, and we're interested in population genetics with trying to tease apart the different evolutionary forces that are shaping patterns of genetic variation, things like natural selection or demographic events such as population size changes, like population crashes or expansions. And all of these things sort of leave their footprints in patterns of genetic variation within species. So we're sort of interested in going backwards, taking these patterns of variation and making inferences about the evolutionary forces at play. And it turns out that machine learning is a great way to go about doing this, because you have a lot of high dimensional data and we're trying to sort of, you know, churn out as much information from it as we can.
Very cool. One question that just jumps out at me is, you mentioned that your study, or maybe evolutionary biology in general, is focused on recent changes in genomes. What does that mean in this context?
Yeah, sorry, let me clarify. Population genetics, my sort of subfield within evolutionary biology, is often more concerned with recent changes, because recent evolutionary events, because those are the things that shape present day patterns of genetic variation.
So, okay. Yeah. And so how recent is that in this context?
Yeah, so it depends on the organism, and you know, there are sort of theoretical expectations for sort of how far back in time you can see based on present day patterns of variation. And without going into the theory, the idea is essentially that if you take one, well, let's start with one human individual. So humans have two copies of each chromosome, one from mom, one from dad. And if you compare those two copies, you'll see a bunch of differences. And that is because these two chromosomes at some point in the past were derived from the same ancestor, but enough time has passed since then that new mutations have occurred and everything, and therefore you see differences between the two. So we expect that those two chromosomes will have been separated, you know, on separate sort of evolutionary trajectories for the last two N generations, where N is the population size. So that's sort of the expectations for humans. That turns into something like a scale of hundreds of thousands of years. And using population genetic approaches, you have more resolution to say something about kind of the more medium, the intermediate and recent subset of that range. So up until the last 50,000 years or so, we have a lot more power to see what's going on. And once you get back sort of 500,000 years ago, you're sort of running out of information there. But that's sort of the time range that we're talking about. And to put that into some context, you know, 500,000 years in humans, you know, they can compare that to the time since our split with chimpanzees, which was about 5 to 6 million years ago.
Maybe walk us through some of the biological concepts that might be handy in kind of exploring what you do and how you apply machine learning.
Sure. So I think sort of the key concept is that we are dealing with a sample of genomes. So it's not cost effective to sequence every genome in the population. So we draw some random subset and sample them, and then what we get is a string of letters, A, C's, G's, and T's for each of the individuals that we've sequenced. And then we're sort of putting that together into this matrix, where each row in the matrix is one genome sequence, and each column in the matrix is one site along that genome as we're moving along. So the human genome, for example, is about 3 billion of these sites. Now, not every one of those sites will exhibit variations. There's not always useful information there that we're going to look at, but you know, it's a lot of columns in this matrix. So that's sort of the data that we're dealing with. Then there are a number of questions that we're interested in answering with that data. One area of research that has been a major focus of mine for the last several years is looking for the signatures of natural selection. So if a new mutation shows up in a population and is harmful, then it will be rapidly removed by natural selection, because individuals bearing that mutation will be less likely to reproduce. And therefore, in that region of the genome, you might expect to see a deficit of diversity. If, on the other hand, a new mutation appears and it's beneficial, then it will rapidly increase in frequency, because you know, individuals harboring it are more likely to survive, reproduce, and leave offspring. So after some number of generations, this mutation has increased in frequency to the point where it has replaced the ancestral version of that site in the genome. And this will also create a sort of distinct characteristic signature of selection that we can try to uncover by using some of these computational techniques. So, there are a whole number of other interesting areas in population genetics that are doing similar types of research where, you know, we're taking this sort of input matrix and trying to infer what is going on there. But the natural selection question has been one that's especially near and dear to my heart over the last few years, at least.
Okay. Does that depend on or assume that you are doing a complete sequence of the genome for the samples that you're working with, or are you able to make inferences based on partial sequences as well?
You can use partial sequences. And in fact, population genetics as, you know, an empirical discipline has existed for quite some time, long before we were able to sequence entire genomes, especially of organisms like humans, where we have this large complex genome. There's sort of, we refer to this as kind of a shift from population genetics to population genomics, because for much of the field's history, we were interested in what's going on at, say, one gene rather than looking at patterns of variation across an entire genome. But now, with increases in the speed and cost effectiveness of DNA sequencing technologies, we're now able to look at variation at a genome-wide scale. So yeah, you're not limited to cases where you have whole genome data, but it's getting to the point now where anybody can sequence a genome. Anybody who has a lab and modest research funding can sequence a fairly large sample of genomes.
And when you're doing the type of experiments that you describe where you're trying to understand natural selection, is the implication of what you describe that you're kind of fundamentally looking at stable sections of the genome as opposed to those sections of the genome that tend to exhibit a lot of variation? Or are you looking at those as well for different things?
Yeah, so in my work, a lot of what I do is I'm sort of trying to walk along the genome and look at how sort of the landscape of variation changes. So you'll have some areas where there's a lot of variation, some where there is not, and we try to make sense of that by sort of segmenting the genome into these different classes or evolutionary models. So this chunk of the genome looks like it's being shaped by positive selection, which is that scenario where a beneficial mutation has recently increased in frequency, or this region of the genome seems to be experiencing negative or purifying selection, where harmful mutations are being removed, and this region of the genome seems to be evolving relatively free from selection. So mutations don't really affect fitness; they're just kind of drifting around randomly over time. So their frequencies are fluctuating, but it has nothing to do with any sort of selective benefit or harm caused by the mutation. So, basically I'm trying to figure out how much of the genome is evolving under one particular model of evolution versus another, and so on. I'm interested in the landscape as you move across chromosomes.
And so you recently published a paper called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Convolutional Neural Networks in Population Genetic Inference. Actually, that came out earlier this month. We're speaking at middle of February. And that was published in Molecular Biology and Evolution. Can you talk a little bit about that particular paper and what it is trying to convey?
Yeah, so this paper is purely methodological in focus, and that we're sort of interested in the different statistical and computational methods that population geneticists have been using over the years. And a major focus of my work over the last 5 years has been to try to incorporate machine learning techniques into population genetic inference. And I should probably start there before I get into this paper, because this is kind of the culmination of a lot of that.
I was wondering just that, if it was the culmination of a trajectory of things that you've tried in machine learning applied to population genetics, or if you, I also talk to scientists that kind of you know, just luck into hearing about or finding out about CNNs and deep learning and apply it to their problem, and bam, it just works, and they kind of start there. So how did that evolve for you?
The way this evolved for me was around the time that I was finishing up in grad school and getting started with my postdoctoral research. I was becoming increasingly interested in this question of, you know, how much can we learn about natural selection from looking at genomic data? And the methods for doing this in population genetics, I found were, to me, they seemed a little bit antiquated in that they were often focused on taking your alignments, you know, this matrix that I'm talking about, this matrix of genome sequences, and sort of boiling it down to a single number. So describing your sequence data by a single statistic, which is descriptive, and it tells you something about how much variation is there in this alignment, or what are the frequencies of mutations in this alignment? Are some of them very common within the population, or are they very rare? To what extent are two mutations correlated? That is, if an individual has a mutation at site one, does that tell you something about whether he also has a mutation at site two? There are a large number of statistics that all sort of capture different, somewhat redundant, but somewhat complementary patterns of variation. And there's kind of this cottage industry in population genetics of coming up with a new statistic that you think is the best one for answering the question that you're looking at, and sort of describing the theoretical expectations for the statistic under various evolutionary models, and, you know, applying this to some data and seeing what you can learn. Now, that's all great, but, you know, you can imagine that if you take this large matrix of genome sequence data and boil it down to a single number, you're probably throwing out a lot of useful information, right? So the work that I was doing during my postdoc, and there's some other labs that are doing this too, I'm not the only one doing this, but it was sort of a small group of population geneticists doing this, and we were just trying to incorporate as much of this information as we could into a method. And one way to do that is to, instead of using one of these statistics, use a large vector of them, throw them all in to a vector, and try something like a support vector machine or a random forest. So you can use a support vector machine and train it to distinguish between natural selection or no natural selection.
Yeah, if I can jump in just to make sure I understand what you're doing, you've got kind of this underlying set of data, which is essentially these alignments. You've got genomes or genome samples that are aligned with one another. And the first thing you did was you took the traditional metrics that have been applied to these alignments and you kind of calculated all of them, put those into a vector, and then use machine learning to, for example, identify clusters within the vector space that you created of these summary statistics. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So the idea is, you know, if, like, rather than arguing over which one of these summary statistics is best, we should see how well we can do if we use all of them at once, right? And machine learning is one way for you to do that, because, you know, you can use it for, you know, higher dimensional data. So,
and when you say how well you do, what was the specific problem, or what are the types of problems that you're trying to solve? Is it just clustering them together, or are there other problems that you apply this technique to?
Yeah, so a lot of population genetic inference is about discriminating between different evolutionary models. So let's go back to this question of, can we find whether there has been a recent beneficial mutation that has increased in frequency and, you know, become what we call fixed or ubiquitous within the population. So a little bit of terminology, we call this a selective sweep, because this mutation is selected and it sweeps through the population. So this problem of finding selective sweeps is a very difficult one, but it's one that's sort of central to PopGen research, because we're interested in how much recent adaptation, you know, particular species might be having, whether it's humans or anything else. You know, how are we responding to the selective environment that we're in? So you can use this information to tell you something about how much adaptation is there, which parts of the genome are responsible for this adaptation, but it all boils down to this model selection thing. Can I discriminate between regions of the genome that are experiencing a sweep and those that are not? So the way that I have gone about this model selection is by training a classifier to do it.
Is the data just the sequences, at least at this point in your application of machine learning, is it just the sequences, or is it the sequences, for example, and the I guess I'm curious about if there's some element of time that's captured, like the, you know, birth or death or, you know, the timestamp of the sequence or something like that. And you're looking at these sequences over a long period of time. Is it like a time series thing, or are you able to infer these sweeps just by looking at a t equals zero set of samples and the way that they're distributed?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. So generally we do, you know, think about the scenario where you only have sampling from one time point. So, you know, you've randomly sampled from some population, you know, last year, and you have this data set, and you're trying to use it to make these inferences about, you know, recent evolutionary history. And a large reason for that, I mean, there are two reasons for that. One is the practical cost of accumulating sequence data, and that cost has gone down. I'll come back to that in a second. And the other is that if you want to do this sort of time series thing, you need to say you want to sample every generation. Well, if you're doing that in humans, then, you know, each generation, you know, might be 25, 30 years or so. So to sort of capture any interesting patterns there, you have to be accumulating data over a long period of time. Now, some organisms have much more rapid generation times. I also work on fruit flies and mosquitoes, and, you know, these things, rather than having one generation every few dozen years, they'll have a dozen or so generations in 1 year. So over the course of a few years, you can accumulate a large number of generations and create time series data. And this is something that's becoming feasible now with improvements in sequencing technology. So I would say that that's kind of a small subset of the kind of landscape of PopGen research right now, but you're going to be seeing that changing very rapidly, I think. So you'll see a lot of this time series analysis, but right now it's mostly just looking at this one snapshot.
So at this stage where you're creating a classifier, you've got this data, as we discussed, it tends to be from a single period of time, or a period of time, I'm assuming, that where you can kind of, they're close enough that you can kind of ignore time as a big factor. And you've collected this data. Can you talk a little bit about the data collection process?
So this is where it gets a little bit tricky, because in sort of more traditional applications of machine learning, you want to collect training data. And here we can't do that. You know, we collect data that we can apply something to, right? We can sequence a bunch of human genomes that we want to run our classifier on. But how do we get a data set where we know what the ground truth is?
Right.
And, you know, that can be tricky in evolutionary biology, because, you know, while we are doing our best to make evolutionary inferences, it's difficult to nail down with absolute certainty, right? What is the evolutionary history of, you know, this species, this population, or this gene? So what we do is we simulate. So there are these nice idealized models of evolution that allow you to simulate an evolving population and sequences within this population. So you can produce synthetic data that one can then use to train a classifier. So then the tricky part is, you know, how do we simulate this thing? How do we parameterize these simulations? And you know, you have to be careful to sort of try to make these simulations match your data as best as you can. But if you knew exactly how your data, you know, how your organism of interest was evolving, then you wouldn't be needing to do the research anyway, right? Because you already know everything. So it's kind of analogous to doing some sort of Bayesian inference, where you've got, you know, these priors, And, you know, here we're simulating under those priors to generate training data, and you have to examine what is the robustness of this classifier to model misspecification. What if I'm wrong about the parameters of this simulation? What if I thought the population size of this organism was 1 million, but actually it's 500,000. How does that affect the accuracy of my downstream analysis? So you have to take all these things into account.
Is there some like prototypical human genome that you use as the starting place for your simulation, or some kind of standard human? Yeah. How does that work?
Yeah. So there is. That's a great question. So we typically refer to these as reference genomes. So for the way that sequencing started out, like this approach was that you would go and create one very high quality genome sequence for your species. We did this in humans, and it took over a decade and $1 billion to sequence the first human genome, which we call the reference genome. But it's this very high quality sequence, and you can use that by using these cheap and fast DNA sequencing technologies, which produce a bunch of very tiny chunks of DNA sequence that you then search against that reference genome. So that's this. That's how you create these alignments that I was referring to, by doing sequence searches and figuring out, okay, this tiny little chunk here that goes to this part on chromosome 1, I can figure that out by searching it against the reference genome. So there are sort of these two different tiers of genome sequences. There are these very high quality reference genomes, and then there are these genomes produced from these rapid sequencing technologies that are mapped against the reference genome in order to reveal variation. Because you take this tiny chunk from this individual that you've sequenced, you map it to the reference, and you see, oh, okay, this little chunk or read, we call it, it's identical to this portion of the reference genome except for this one difference. And if you accumulate enough evidence for those differences, then you know, okay, that is a mutation that's present in my population.
And then you referenced needing to make sure you get the population size right. In the case of humans, for example, where does the complexity come in there? And like, is it correct relative to this reference genome and the specifics of the population you're sampling? Or, you know, what kind of resolution do you need there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And this is still a very open area of research. You know, obviously, you can go get the census population size of humans today, or a pretty good approximation of it, but that has not been the size of our population over much of our history. There's been dramatic changes, of course, growth most recently, but in many populations, there were contractions, especially with those populations that migrated out of Africa. That migration was associated with a large population bottleneck. So the population size history in humans it's messy, it's non-monotonic, and it concludes with this very rapid super exponential explosion that's been going on for the last few hundred years now. So to what extent can we accurately model these population size changes? That's another area of research that actually we touch upon a little bit in the CNN paper that we'll be talking about. Yeah, I don't know if I answered your question enough.
I think you did. My takeaway was it's complicated.
Yeah, okay. Then I think I did a good job.
Yeah. So you're doing this simulation. You're applying kind of Bayesian types of methods. You're trying to apply probability distributions at different points in the simulation process. I guess the question is, are you doing that per read or SNP or something like that? Or are you doing that on a sequence level? Like, are we at the point where we're modeling variability and distributions on a kind of subsequence level? Or is it kind of a more coarse-grained model today?
Yeah, so for the most part, we're interested in sort of zooming in and looking at relatively small regions of the genome. So that's kind of what we're simulating, to sort of come up with expectations for patterns of variation within, say a size of the genome that's spanning, a few dozen genes, something like that, or less sometimes, something on the order of a single gene. So, typically we're looking at smaller regions, but for some questions, especially this question of trying to infer demographic changes like population size changes, we want to be looking at patterns of variation across the whole genome, because if there's a population crash, that affects the amount of genetic variation across the entire genome. So we want to use as much of that data as possible. Mm-hmm. So, another development in our field in recent years is it's become feasible to simulate larger and larger genomes. So we can sort of capture the expected dynamics genome-wide, not just, at a gene or a few genes. So we do the whole gamut, I guess.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And so this approach to training a classifier based on the sequences and simulated results to provide your ground truth was one of your first steps in the direction of applying machine learning to PopGen. You know, was the CNN the next step, or did you have a few more steps to get there?
Yeah, so I played around with this approach on, a few different problems. I was mostly interested in this natural selection question, but I branched out to a few different areas. I kind of got a little bit caught up in trying to push along a cultural change in our field in population genetics. I was trying to make the point to people that these machine learning methods are not scary. We should consider trying to use them for, every question where it is appropriate, and see how well they compare to our more traditional methods. So another question that I was looking into was this question of finding gene flow. So this is the scenario where you have two different populations. They diverged some time ago, say African and non-African humans. They split some time ago when non-Africans migrated out of the African continent and, colonized Eurasia. And we want to know, after that split, did these populations come back into contact at a certain time point and exchange genetic material? And if so, can we find the genomic regions where there has been this gene flow? So, probably the African non-African question isn't the best example of this, because the genetic exchange is across the entire genome in cases where there has been the secondary contact, like African Americans, for example, have European ancestry across the basically entire genome, as well as African ancestry. A better example is probably Neanderthals. So you may have heard, it's been reported in the news, that we now know that Neanderthals have donated genetic material to Eurasian, Asians and Europeans, humans. So a typical European individual has maybe 2-4% of their DNA tracing its ancestry back to Neanderthals. So after the split between the ancestral population that gave rise to modern humans and also Neanderthals, these two species eventually found themselves in the same location, and there was interbreeding there. And we can sort of see the genetic remnants of that in certain parts of the human genome. So I got into this question of detecting regions where there has been regions of the genome where there has been the flow of genetic material from one population into another. And of course, here there have been a large number of statistical approaches devised over the years to detect these patterns. And I took the same approach of creating a machine learning a classifier that uses a vector of these statistics to discriminate between these different models. So here are three models where there is no gene flow between these two populations, or within this genomic window, there's gene flow from population 1 to population 2, and vice versa. And of course, it works much better than any method that is using just one statistic, because you're throwing out all that information. So if you incorporate as much information as you can into the feature vector, you you produce more accurate inferences. So I was going around talking about that work, going to conferences, you know, trying to sell this stuff to people, say like, you know, this machine learning stuff works. We should, you know, here's the evidence. And somebody in the audience of that talk was interested and went and looked at my code and thought, well, what happens if I get rid of this part that calculates all the statistics and just replace it with a convolutional neural network? So, you know, let a neural net come up with its own statistics and see how well it can answer this question. And this person was Lex Flagel, who is the first author on that paper published in MBE. And Lex sent me an email one day, and the day I opened up this email was the most exciting day of my professional life. He opened this up and was like, hey, I got this result. I was playing around with the convolutional neural net and thought I'd see how it did. And here are the results. Is this good? So I pull up my data and I'm comparing, and I'm like, huh, this is better than mine. So yeah. So there had been a few conversations I'd had in the years leading up to this about, you know, this idea of, you know, maybe using deep learning or some approach that's able to act directly on the alignment rather than pre-digesting it into a bunch of features or summary statistics. But I never had a chance to get around to it. And, you know, then suddenly there on my screen was the evidence that not only can you do this, but it works really well, better than what I was trying at the time. So we knew right away, I knew right away, that we had to try this out on a bunch of different problems in population genetics to see if this approach would work in general. And that was the work that led to the MBE paper.
In the paper, you're doing just that. You're trying CNNs out on a bunch of these different problems. Does each of these problems represent one of the statistics that you were kind of aggregating together in your previous work? Or are the problems kind of at a higher level and the statistics, you know, informed approaches to the problems?
Yeah, so these problems have been major areas of research in PopGen for quite some time. So the different problems we touch on in the paper are this problem of finding selective sweeps, this problem of finding gene flow. We try to infer population size changes, and the other is inferring the rate of recombination. So recombination is when during meiosis, you're two different chromosome copies exchange genetic material with one another. So it sort of breaks up the association between mutations along a chromosome. So, you know, you would think that if you're looking at, say, chromosome 1 in the human genome, like if you take one of your copies of chromosome 1 as you're going back in time, that whole chromosome should have the same evolutionary history, you know, as you trace it back through ancestor to ancestor. But recombination breaks that up. Different chunks of the chromosome have different ancestors. And it's a longstanding problem in population genetics, trying to infer how much of this recombination happens in different parts of the genome. So can you infer the recombination rate landscape across the genome? And you can try to do this using population genetic data. So a bunch of methods exist for doing that. All of these problems have gotten a lot of attention from researchers over the years. So there's not just one statistic for each of them. There are dozens for many of them. So we were comparing our approach of just throwing it all into a CNN and seeing what answer comes out to many of these statistics that have been used or vectors of those statistics, you know, like the approach I had been using up to that point of throwing them all into a classifier and using something like a random forest.
Can you talk a little bit about the approach to making your data fit well within the paradigm of CNNs? Did you need to do anything special there?
Yeah, you certainly do. And because we wanted this to sort of be a proof of principle, we were focusing on simulated data in this paper just to show that this can work in principle. and it can work better than some of the best methods that we have at our disposal right now. We didn't want to get too deep into the rabbit hole of all the things that you have to do when you're working with real data that can be messy. So we kind of skipped a lot of this stuff, or just pointed out that these are issues that one have to deal with. But I think that the deep learning approach is probably better suited for dealing with a lot of these problems than some of the more traditional approaches.
Because, and so what are some of those problems?
Yeah, so a common problem is that there can be parts of the genome where you just don't have a lot of information, where, you know, you've mapped these reads, but you're not exactly sure where they go, or the reads are of low quality, so you're not exactly sure what nucleotide is there, what the base is. So there's low confidence data or missing data, and you have to sort of mask these out. So dealing with this, I think, is actually pretty straightforward. In this machine learning framework, you take a look at your actual data and see, like, sort of what's the distribution of missing data along my genome, and then just adjust your simulations accordingly. You know, synthetically mask some portion of your training data and your simulated test data, and then train. It's a lot more easy to do this when your input is, you know, just the sequence matrix rather than some statistic that has been calculated across the matrix, and it might not be designed to deal with missing data. You know, we don't really have to deal with that. We just have to supply training data that we think kind of matches what the input data look like.
You know, we think of CNNs, we most frequently think of image data that has kind of this often square or two-dimensional or three-dimensional with channels kind of structure. How did your sequence data map to that?
Yeah, so we were using two-dimensional data where each row in your matrix is a genome sequence and each column is one site. The shape of this matrix is different from what you might find in a typical image or something like the ImageNet database, because you might have something like 50 rows. You know, 50 is a fairly small number of pixels, but you may have thousands of columns, you know, maybe 10,000. So you could have these very oblong matrices that you're shoving in there. So we're actually using primarily 1D convolutions within the paper, kind of treating these more as time series data than as image data. And myself have also played around with applying different flavors of RNNs, and I know some other researchers that are doing that as well now. So they don't look exactly, you know, in terms of their shape, like a typical image that you'd be throwing a CNN at.
This is kind of a nit, I guess, but I'm curious if you did like a one-hot encoding on your proteins, your individual genes?
The way that we encode the sequence data is basically zeros and ones. In a lot of population genetics, we are only concerning ourselves with what we call biallelic sites, those sites where there are two different variants. So, you know, maybe I have an A and, you know, you have a G at this site. We'll just think of those two different alleles as zero and one. So just a matrix of zeros and ones. And, if we are trying to use that information to find selective sweeps, then we'll have different classes. There are a few different types of selective sweeps. Say zero for one particular type of sweep, one for another, and, you know, two for a neutrally evolving region of the genome. Those are our class labels. And, you know, we'll make a one hot encoded vector of those classes. But yeah, the input matrix is just a 2D matrix of zeros and ones.
Okay.
For now. But I mean, there's a lot of, other different ways of encoding that one could try out here. And I think it's important to stress here, and I'm sure a lot of listeners of your podcast will gather that we are very far behind the machine learning field, the deep learning field, when it comes to population genetics. We are, you know, just sort of trying things out right now, and we're trying out neural nets that, you know, or at least 5 years or more behind the state of the art. So there's a lot of catching up to do and a lot of experimentation with different network architectures, different input encodings and things like that that we have to try out.
So can you give us a summary of the results you saw for these four different types of problems?
Yeah. So that's easy. Basically, deep learning, if trained carefully, it can at least match the current state-of-the-art methods, if not handily outperform them for most of the problems that we've looked at. So the one case where I think there's a lot more work to be done that we just sort of gave a simple first attempt at was this question of trying to infer population size histories. You know, it's the method we came up with worked fairly well there, but we want to be able to scale up to genome scale data and a simple CNN approach where you have an image that encompasses an entire genome of billions of base pairs is at least beyond our capabilities at the moment computationally, and it's probably not the appropriate method for that anyway. Something like a recurrent neural net of some kind might be more appropriate. But for these questions of finding gene flow, finding selective sweeps, inferring recombination rates, the results were pretty stunningly amazing. And that's why we gave it the title, in reference to the popular unreasonable effectiveness meme in statistics. We were certainly blown away by how well this stuff worked, and we wanted to share that enthusiasm with the field and get people to consider these types of methods in the future for their own work.
Awesome. And so where do you go from here?
Yeah, so I have started my lab here at UNC almost a year ago, and we're continuing some work along these lines. So I have a postdoc right now who's very interested in trying to dive deeper into this question of population size changes and trying out a variety of methods, including deep learning methods to answer these and other demographic questions. So, the deep learning is definitely still a part of it. I have another postdoc who is working on phylogenomic questions. So phylogenomics is a different field of evolutionary biology where you're looking at sequences from different species rather than sequences within one population, within one species, and trying to make inferences like just inferring the species tree that connects them. So figuring out the relationship among species, trying to fill out the tree of life. And he's also trying out deep learning methods there. Yeah, it's not my plan to have a lab that's entirely based on machine learning and deep learning, but when you've had some success using these methods and they've got the cool buzzwords, so it attracts talent, and the people who want to join are interested in doing deep learning. So I guess that's what I'm going to do, right? you're limited by who you can recruit. So, we're enjoying it a lot. Sort of trying to push the envelope to see how much we can learn by applying these methods to genomic data. Yeah, there's other stuff that I am interested in doing that is not at all related to machine learning, but that's probably a topic for a different conversation.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us about your work. It's really exciting to see how deep learning and machine learning in general is applied to these types of problems in population genetics.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam. And I'm looking forward to seeing how this stuff evolves over the next few years, because I want to be clear, there are some other labs working on this as well, and I want to see where they take it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. For more information on Dan or any of the topics covered in today's episode, visit twimlai.com/talk/249. Be sure to register for PegaWorld using the code TWIML19 for $200 off of registration. As always, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.